We're glad you're joining us here at NRCC Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts.
So, here's the thing. The minister of a local church should not have to write a whole book that strips sexuality and how we think about educating one another about our sexuality all the way down to the core. Shouldn't have to explore history and science and anthropology and economics to unearth the wisdom about human sexuality, to understand religion's sex craziness so we can step back from it, understand the accumulated wisdom of the generations that is embedded in religion. Shouldn't have to do that. But the sex education that we've been doing, it isn't working. What religion has been doing isn't working, and really what society has been doing isn't working. It isn't just our sex norms that aren't working for us. None of the social institutions that work on these things are doing very well these days. So, a book. Social institutions are built and then refined in a world. In other words, we figure out how to make our social institutions work in the world that we live in. And if we do that long enough, pretty soon they work pretty well until that world goes away. And when that world goes away, then those institutions don't work as well. Government that is designed to work pretty well at one level of complexity struggles to cope when the world emerges into a higher level of complexity. And the same is true of our educational systems and our economic systems and our family systems. They're all crafted to work pretty well when society is humming along at one level of complexity. But when social complexity takes a giant leap forward, institutional structures can't handle it. They weren't designed for that level of complexity, and things stop working. So, people, being emotional beings as we are, when things stop working, we tend to get worked up. We tend to defend, or we tend to blame, or we tend to get in this fighting posture with one another. But what we ought to be doing at moments in history like this one is stripping things down to the core, figuring out what from the past should be carried with us that will inform health and well-being as we go forward, and what is going to need to be completely reconfigured for the new reality in which we now live. And some generations, ours is one of them, are required to do that kind of work. And so the minister of a local church has to write a whole book with history and science and biology and economics, trying to figure out something as basic as human sexuality and how we educate our young. Now, the subtitle of the book is The Wisdom of Religion Without the Crazy. That suggests that religion holds a great wisdom about sexual health and about well-being for us personally, for us communally, as a group and as a society. But we've seen, in order to access that wisdom, we have to dismantle a whole lot of what doesn't work. And so we went back earlier weeks to look at the 2nd century and the 5th century and how we got it wrong and how we kind of created this dirty sex construct. So here's the thing. When we look around and do research into what's actually going on, it turns out that religious people and non-religious people alike are not really following religion's old rule. The rule was no sex until marriage. And so many, many people have abandoned that as a rule. And in our world, even among those people who still advocate for the rule, the numbers are in, we're just not following the rule. But here's the thing that often gets overlooked, and that is that rule worked really well for a long, long time. And I think we ought to understand why it worked as long as it did, as well as it did, before we abandon it. We want the same wisdom that rule was able to access. And we have to access that wisdom so that we can, in this new world that we live in, begin to build new rules of thumb that will help us access the same wisdom. Because the rules have to change when the world changes. But the wisdom is deeply rooted in our humanity. But that hasn't been what we've done. Again, being emotional beings as we are, we've tended to focus on defending or on blaming. It is kind of what we do. Our tendency has been, once we found out that the rule wasn't working, was to malign it and to dismiss it as out of touch, or to call it repressive, and to do that before we had a thorough understanding of what it was doing that was working when it was working. Consequently, we threw it out, maligned, and didn't replace it with much of anything at all. We certainly didn't discern the wisdom that it was accessing and then apply that new wisdom in a new construct. So, the rule was hammered out when the world worked one way. And then, in historical terms, in the blink of an eye, everything changed. Because for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, we lived in agrarian societies. And then for about 200 years, we lived in industrial societies. And in what is such a rapid historical time span, everything changed. In the old world, we built society on the basis of physical strength. Consequently, income work was primarily the domain of men with greater upper body strength. Sexual roles were then defined on the basis of who was doing the income work and who wasn't. But now we live in a world of keyboards and robotics, and work has become much more mental than physical. And now work, income work, has become the domain of both genders. And that has changed forever traditional gender roles. But even more disruptive than the upending of gender roles has been the complexity of mental work. Mental work is much more complex than physical work, which means that now it takes much more preparatory time for young people to be ready to go to work, for young people to be ready to enter into society, for young people to be able to establish their careers and become contributors. What used to be able to be done by the time of late teenage now takes late 20s before we're ready. And it's what I've called the 15-year problem. Because food is abundant, as happens, puberty now happens earlier in our society. And because of the complexity of work, readiness for society happens later. It used to be, for much of human history, that the time from sexual maturity to readiness to form a sexual pair bond, that time used to be 3 or 4 or 5 years. And it is now 15 or 18 years. And in that context, the traditional rule has stopped working. So, in that context, when we went from 3 or 4 or 5 years to 15 to 18 years, yes, the traditional rule stopped working. But now, because the rule stopped working, that does not mean that the wisdom stopped being wise. Again, over these last weeks, we've talked about how that rule accessed this rich body of wisdom and saved a whole lot of people a whole lot of sexual pain, created strong pair bonds that advantaged children for many, many generations who grew up in the stability of those pair bonds, and that all happened with that rule in that world. But here's the thing, that world is gone. But rather than figuring out the wisdom that the rule captured, we didn't go back and create new rules that would capture that same wisdom. Rather, we defaulted to a set of no rules rules. Consent and condoms and not much more. which, as we've seen these last few weeks, does not do justice to the psychological and emotional and relational processes that accompany physical sexual intimacy. The forming of pair bonds that are strong and that last require something of our humanity that the no norms don't access, which has put us in kind of a hole. A shared sexual narrative that would normally support us, and institutions that work with that narrative that would normally support us, they're not here. We don't have a shared sexual story, and we don't have institutions that are working to reinforce and to support us in that story. And so what we've settled on, as we saw last week, is it's just sex, which has created some really adverse effects. It's created a whole lot of sexual pain, a whole lot of broken pair bonds, and it has given us an unsettled sense that things are getting worse rather than better. So yeah, that's kind of put us in a hole. But here's how generations like ours start to get out of the hole. It starts with small groups like ours, realizing that the rule isn't working, realizing that the sexual Wild West isn't working either, and figuring out that the emperor has no clothes, and going back into history and science and economics and seeking wisdom. And since religion, when religion is at its best, plays the role in society of accumulating the wisdom of the generations and then passing that wisdom along to subsequent generations, religion is a great place for us to go back and seek what is the wisdom under the crazy that religion has accumulated about human sexuality. And when we do that, as I did in the book, and as we've touched on these last few weeks, there is a wisdom there for us to inform the new world that will need to be created. We've seen, one of the three things that we've seen is this, that lovemaking happens in an interconnected web of many ways that human beings make love. Eroticism is only one of those many ways. Each supports and each reinforces and each builds upon all of the others. But for reasons that we've seen, social and economic, we have separated eroticism out from the others and unintentionally forced it to stand on its own, leaving it unsupported from the whole web of the ways that human beings make love, leaving it unsupported by philos and philautia and storge, and especially as we saw last week, pragma. Without those supports, then, love making cannot last because it isn't sustainable. It was designed to exist in this interconnected web, and when we remove it from that web, a whole lot of sexual pain, a whole lot of broken pair bonds, and an unsettled sense that it's getting worse. We also saw that there is a deep accumulated wisdom that religion has carried through the years that has long sought to honor the energy of both masculine sexuality and feminine sexuality. When we put guidelines in place, we saw we were protecting what is often unprotected in a society, the yin as well as the yang of our sexual energies. And when we do that, We avoid the trap into which our own society has fallen, becoming imbalanced by honoring one or the other, or over-honoring one and under-honoring another. And again, that creates a whole lot of sexual pain, broken pair bonds, and this unsettled sense that things are getting worse. And the third thing that we saw is that there is a timing associated with healthy sexual bonds forming. By giving human beings the times that we need for psychological and emotional and relational processes that are necessary to ready us for relationship, necessary to develop full acceptance of one another, necessary to take emotional ownership of the relationship, and to develop the trust and commitments that are prerequisite to pair bonds that last, these processes, we've seen, take time. Now, the old rule stumbled into that timetable almost by accident in a way that worked in that world. But now we've come to see that that old rule doesn't capture the same wisdom. We still need to access the wisdom. By the way, if you missed any of the detail from those weeks, you can have a catch-up online. Now, here's the thing. When we talk about the interconnected web, or we talk about the timing that it takes to form strong pair bonds, or when we talk about balancing the masculine and the feminine, these are big human themes. They're big sexual themes. They are so big that they get integrated into our lives better when they are integrated into the culture in which we live. When we grow up with a shared understanding of our sexuality that brings us to health and well-being, when we grow up in institutions that then train us to adopt these healthy practices, that's the best way that human beings integrate big themes like these into our lives. That's what healthy culture does. That's what healthy institutions do. They capture the wisdom of the ages, they turn it into followable norms, and then they reinforce those norms in our lives. Healthy culture, healthy institutions create peer pressure that pressures us toward life and health and well-being. But when we're in the hole, as we are in this historical moment, that's what we don't have. We don't have a healthy shared sexual narrative. We don't have institutions that will reinforce that narrative in our lives. We're kind of all figuring it out as we go. But we are not powerless. Historical change happens when groups of people do exactly what we're doing together. People who would normally not have to do this kind of work, a local church shouldn't have to do this, people who don't normally have to do this kind of work, ministers and parents talking with other parents and youth groups like ours with Angie and Michael figuring out how to transmit this kind of wisdom to our teenagers, working together to figure out how to live our own lives and talk with our kids, inviting one another into a countercultural narrative and countercultural sexual norms. This invent-it-by-ourselves work is more difficult, but we are not without support. Unlike other generations, it's not being handed to us by our elders. It's not being handed to us by our institutions. But here's the thing about our young people. They're young now. Here's the thing about our community. We're making our sexual decisions now. And whether we follow the ancient wisdom or don't, we are suffering the consequences or enjoying the consequences of our choices. And so it behooves us to be informed. It behooves us to understand and be able to talk about and be able to have shared conversations about what makes for healthy sexuality. And I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen in families. I've seen it happen among families talking together about their teenagers, having important conversations about how sane it is to do something countercultural when the culture has become insane. When we look at 70% of our pair bonds failing, we might not want to look to the norms that our culture has created for forming pair bonds. So that's why I wrote the chapter in the book with the list of readiness questions. Because it was to take these broad concepts about the interconnected web, the broad concepts about masculine and feminine energy, the broad concepts about timing and what it takes to form strong pair bonds, and take all this accumulated wisdom and frame it into a series of conversations that we can be having with one another and in age-appropriate ways with our young people. So the book, that chapter has a bunch of questions like, young person, are you ready for X? Have you given Y the time that it needs? And do you know what Z demands of you? And have you considered the demands that Z would put on relationships? I put it into a pretty concise chapter so that we can have these kinds of conversations, because that's the work that we do when we don't have the institutional support and the shared narrative support that other generations get. We need to have these discussions. So we need to think about the broad wisdom. We need to be able to frame it in our own minds as grown-ups. We need to think about our own sexual lives through the lens of this ancient wisdom. And then we need to be able to have those conversations with young people. That's an important part of this moment in history. But there's another part about this moment in history that is equally important. And that is, we have to speculate together about what is going to happen that will bring about health and well-being that we will not live to see. We do the speculative work that will prepare subsequent generations to do what they need to do to inform the rebuilding of healthy norms and healthy institutions. That's another job that is needed by generations like ours. Excuse me, and toward that end, let me finish up the lesson with a little bit of that speculation. We have viewed marriage as a once and forever relationship because for most of the 6 to 10,000 years that we have lived in agrarian history, that once and forever meant somewhere between 12 and 20 years because we didn't live as long as we live now. We died pretty early. So even though in our society we don't live in marriage as a once and forever relationship, that much human history doesn't just go away. It gets in us. It's in our guts. It's in our expectations. I said earlier, nobody decides to get into a sexual relationship, into a pair bond, and hope for the day when it ends horribly. Our visceral thinking about pair bonds goes something like this. We meet, we fall in love, we marry, we settle down, we have kids, we grow old, we have an empty nest, we get old, and then we die. And we hope that when we die, what are you laughing at? And we hope that when we die, we're holding the hand of the person that we have loved for a lifetime. And it's a beautiful notion. And I've experienced more of that pattern than I like to admit to myself. And it is a beautiful pattern. And we could even call it sacramental in its beauty. But here's the thing about generations like ours. We have to understand more deeply than just the inherited intuitions that we picked up from time. Because we're going to have to reconstruct, deconstruct, and reconstruct. We have to know what's going on under the surface. And so we have to understand the accumulated wisdom of time so that we can apply it in the new world. Well, that process I just described, that fall in love, grow old, and die process, it actually breaks into three different stages, and we need to know that to be able to prepare for the institutions and the norms of the future. There are three stages of a sexual relationship, each needing its own set of commitments. We make a set of commitments for healthy, youthful sexual love. And those commitments are different than the commitments we make that will allow us to raise children and to advantage the offspring. And those are different still from the commitments that we make for the companionship and support that we commit to one another as we become elders and as we approach death together. And again, they're not the same commitments. Each stage requires a new set of commitments. Well, I've made all three of those commitments, and turns out you got to renegotiate those at times in life because there is a spike in divorce rate at year one, there's a spike in divorce at years 7 to 10, and there's a spike in divorce at years 20 to 25, correlating with each one of those sets of commitments that we make. And so I've made the same three commitments with the same woman, and again, it is a beautiful way that this thing unfolds, but it doesn't need to be the only way that it unfolds. If we can understand those commitments, it allows us to imagine what new norms might be like when we move into this new world. So a young person facing the 15-year problem may be ready to make all the commitments that they will need to make for healthy, spiritual, youthful, sexual love. But they may not yet be ready because of the extended time that it takes to move into careers to make the commitments that are required for the second set of commitments or the third. So John Shelby Spong, you might have heard of him, a bishop in the Episcopal Church, he suggested that the church begins to formalize, begins to ritualize commitments that are made at each of these three stages. And he called the first set of commitments betrothal. And this is how he described it. He said, the community surrounds young people, helps them understand the wisdom that sexual wisdom that religion holds, helps them work through the readiness questions, helps them understand the commitments that are necessary for this early stage of sexual love, the trust-building work, the owning the relationship work, the psychological and emotional work that we described last week, which then allows the young person to enter consciously this interconnected web of lovemaking in a way that it's just sex doesn't allow. It affords the opportunity for growth and beauty and sanctity even in youthful, healthy sexual relationships. But what it doesn't do is require the same full set of commitments that will be required to move into the second stage of relationship. Because when we agree to bear children together, we must make the strongest commitment that human beings can make. It is wired into us through all of these years of evolutionary history to advantage the offspring. And when we don't give offspring the opportunity for a pair bond that is stable over the time that it takes to prepare them for societies, we do not advantage the offspring. And so this second set of commitments brings us to the place where we quit focusing on what sexual love does for us, and we begin focusing on what sexual love does for them and the lives they will need to live. And, Spong suggests, religion could afford rituals to formalize and to recognize each stages of commitment. Betrothal, that's what he called the first stage, marriage to raise children, and a third ritual as we enter into our elderhood together. Now I tell you that, and then I remind you that I got kicked out of our denomination for the last book I wrote. And knowing when I was writing that book that I was going to write this book, when we were going through that process, I know how challenging that is to embrace if we've grown up in a religious construct. Because I hear in my mind the voices of good people, good Christian people, saying something like, oh my God, what happened to Doug? He's gone off the rails. Because the idea of a whole other category of sexual relationship that could feel like the denial of or the debasing of millennia of human sexual history. And who are we to do that? Now, it may not be that when history unfolds and we create new healthy norms and new healthy institutions to reinforce those norms, that what we settle on is the best way to integrate the ancient wisdom is to have three forms of recognized sexual relationship. That may not be the right answer. But here's what is the right answer. It's going to be different than what we've known. The kind of things that generations like ours must do is rethink our norms. And we do that best if we access the ancient understanding about our humanity, the deep understanding about the psychological and emotional and relational aspects that make for healthy sexual relationships. And then we need to apply that ancient wisdom in the creating of new norms and new institutions that work in the society in which we now live. This has been a tumultuous, seismic upheaval. We live through it one day at a time, but if you look at this from a historical perspective, the world is so fundamentally different than it was. What we did won't continue to work. So that's why I wrote the book, is because we do live in a generation that is in a hole. We don't have the institutional support. We don't have a clear sexual narrative. We don't have an understanding that accesses ancient wisdom and that also works in this new world in which we live. Now, I hope that the book wasn't a first draft of a working narrative. I know that there are some pretty practical tools because I've test-driven most of them, and I've talked to other families that are doing the same. And they do help us do some important thinking and ask some important questions and have important conversations. But what we need to do in this time in history is to access the wisdom of religion, to dismantle the crazy, to understand where it came from, but to integrate that depth of wisdom into a new set of norms and a new set of institutions that support those norms, and that's probably 100 or 200 years' work. So what that means for us is we've got to have the more complex, unsupported conversations with our young people and with one another now. We've got to be speculating about what the future is going to require of us now. We have these conversations so that our children and our grandchildren, who knows, maybe our great-grandchildren, begin to live in a society that supports the health and well-being that is not currently being supported. And so, indwelling Holy Spirit, to have healthy human lives, this is our prayer. To have healthy sexual lives, this is our prayer, and may it be so among us. Amen.
If these recordings help you move forward on your spiritual journey, we hope you'll take an ownership stake in the community and support the health and well-being of the community. You can go to our website, northraleighcommunitychurch.org. The donate button is at the top of the page on your computer's browser, at the bottom on your phone's browser. Thank you.